This podcast is brought to you by Villanova University on iTunes U. Please visit us on itunes.villanova.edu.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to begin with a presentation of the protocol. Hopefully, everybody has the information in front of them. I'll try to cover as much as possible, but if you have information or any clarification, please speak up. The other thing I want to point out before we get started is there's only two members on the stage, and in a normal IRB setting, this wouldn't be sufficient. Most IRBs have between 8 and 12 members, and the quorum is at least 4, 5, or 6 people to have the quorum. The other thing we would need to do before we even started discussing this protocol is we need to verify that A, there was a quorum, and the quorum included at least one non-scientist member, and we'd also have to verify that none of the members reviewing the protocol had a conflict of interest with the protocol.
So the federal regulations say that the IRB has to have at least 5 members, okay? And you have to have scientific expertise. You have to have a member who's not affiliated with the entity, the university. And that means that your spouse can't work there, your kids can't go there, no one living in your household can be part of the entity. So that's unaffiliated. And you cannot convene a meeting without a non-scientist. If the non-scientist is not there, you can't have a meeting. Okay?
Let's get started. Let's look at the case. So we have here is a psychology protocol involving 2 universities. And what they're trying to do, what their research objective is they want to look at the overall mood of college students based on whether the college football team wins or loses. So what they propose to do is measure mood by analyzing changes in the proportion of positive versus negative words in emails sent by students through the university email accounts. Hold that thought. They have obtained agreement from each of the university's IT departments to provide emails with the sending and received addresses hashed. So what they're doing here is they come up with a mechanism to send and receive emails, which makes the emails anonymous. That's going to be very important for our discussion as well. The researchers recognize that student use of emails through their university account is only a small fraction of electronic communications, but they're arguing that the convenience of being able to obtain this anonymized data set makes it possible to test the hypothesis that attending a university with a successful football team boosts student moods, and that doing the analysis of 2 different universities will enhance the generalizability of the results. In both universities, the athletic department sends out text messages with game results to all students with registered phone numbers, except for those who have opted out of receiving such text messages. To reduce variability in these messages, the researchers have obtained the agreement from each university's athletic department to include certain consistent wording in these texts describing the wins and losses. So, for example, everyone at the university should be proud of the way the team played for losses, and everyone at the university should be proud of the way the team won for wins. So the researchers originally proposed that the students did not need to be notified about the study because no identifiable email addresses would be obtained. However, one of the universities notified the investigator that she should be required to send an email to all student users of the email system describing the study and providing a way for them to opt out of having their emails analyzed. For consistency, the investigators now propose to use the same process at both universities. However, the email will say the purpose is to analyze patterns in anonymized student emails without specifically saying that positive and negative words will be counted for, or that the hypothesis is that football teams winning and losing will affect mood. So that's our case. The first thing I'll say broadly about the case is we need more information. And we're going to go through and we're going to talk about the information that we need. One of the things I want to focus on and highlight before we get into the discussion is they say that they have obtained university IT department agreement on receiving on the emails being anonymous. That's very important. So the first thing I would stipulate as part of this protocol review is that we see documentation that this takes place. So in some instances, researchers may say, okay, hey, we talked to IT, we did this. What I would like to do is I'd actually like to get the IT person involved and see what that anonymization process looks like. And we have a lot of requests for clarification on the actual protocol itself. But the first thing I wanted to talk about conceptually is what they're actually proposing to do is they're actually proposing an alteration of the informed consent process. And what I mean by an alteration of the informed consent process is that not all of the required elements of informed consent are present. So in a typical research study with a full informed consent process, even if they were waiving documentation of consent, you'd still be expected to tell people the purpose of the research study, the procedures involved, the risks involved, what you're doing to protect confidentiality, who you contact with questions. That's not really present here in this application. But one thing that could be possible is it could be possible for this team to have an alteration of the consent process. So part of our decision today, or maybe we don't have enough information to make this decision, is does it meet the four criteria for altering the informed consent process? And those four criteria are that the research study be minimal risk. So right off the bat, I probably concur with the investigator that this is a minimal risk research intervention. It involves emails, it involves text messages. These are all things that happen in everyday life. Me personally, a text message from my mother would probably be a lot more upsetting than a text message from this researcher. The other three criteria are, and I'm going to skip the second one because I think that's the hardest one to argue. The waiver would not adversely affect subjects' rights or welfare. And this is really a tough one to answer. And generally it has to do with collecting sensitive data, what kind of reproducible information. And I'm going to say that this would not adversely affect subjects' rights or welfare. I don't think that there's any really negative conclusions you can draw about a student population based on moods of football. I mean, if you were gonna talk about something really sensitive, maybe something about like rape culture on campus, maybe that kind of generalizable knowledge about a specific campus, I think that discussion for that criteria would be a little bit different. But in this case, I don't think mood based on a football team, I don't think anybody's rights or welfare are being adversely affected. The fourth criterion is that pertinent information be provided to subjects after the study is completed. Which I think we're gonna have to put a pin in that, because they don't really have a plan for debriefing these people.
There is some deception involved if they want to do the study the way they say they want to do it. You can't be totally upfront about what's going to happen. Otherwise, they won't collect any viable data.
So that's a good segue for the second one that I skipped over. The second criteria for altering the consent process are that the research would not be practicable or feasible without the waiver or alteration of consent. So this could mean a few things. Sometimes what they basically need to justify in their protocol is that they can't answer this research question or do this research project with an informed consent process. That if they had to individually consent all the students in the university to receive text messages or to receive a specific email that outlined everything that they were going to be doing, it would make the project impractical. Additionally, I think even though we don't have enough information, I think that with some clarity, I think it'd be reasonable to say that, you know, from a scientific standpoint, it would influence the results at this point. If they were to know that this was a research study, it's going to affect the way that they respond to these text messages. If they know somebody's looking at the overall mood on campus, that in and of itself is going to shift the overall mood on campus. That's why there's the four criteria, because any one of them could be okay by itself, but because we determine it's minimal risk, it doesn't adversely affect subjects' rights or welfare. I think we can, I think based on the limited information, that an alteration of the consent process would be reasonable. The one thing I would want to stipulate as part of that, I want to see a little bit more justification regarding the procedural elements of actually getting this opt-out passive consent, which we haven't talked about yet. And I want to see what their plans were for debriefing the student population.
So like I mentioned this morning, you have to present the IRB. If you're going to use any deception, you have to present the IRB for the IRB approval, a script, a mechanism for debriefing, and a script of what you're going to tell the subjects that were involved in the study. So that's, and the IRB has to approve that script. Right. And that's an important aspect of this. So this study would clearly have to come back for another review, I think.
Yeah, I don't think we have enough information. I want to see the debriefing form. I don't really think they have a rationale for waiving the debriefing process. I really can't. So, I reviewed some deception studies where maybe you were going to call a health clinic and say, hey, do you guys accept Medicare services? And, I've seen some situations where the study team has argued debriefing people might actually be more harmful than the research itself, because they come back and say, oh, we did this research study, and it turns out you don't accept Medicare patients, and you should. I don't think anything like that's here. I can't really see a reason why they would waive debriefing, so one of my stipulations that I would say put in a letter is that they provide the debriefing script that's going to be sent around. And I think I could be flexible as to what that would look like. I don't know if that necessarily needs to be an individualized script for everybody, but maybe the emails that went around, maybe they could send an email that said, hey, we did, this is what you knew about before, this is what our research study looked like, these are the findings we have.
I think you could do it that way, electronically, and certainly not need 3,000 individual students to do this, but that's how many people would participate. I guess while we're talking about the emails, I wanted to talk actually a little bit about the information that's presented in the description of the study protocol. So the protocol as presented is pretty woefully inadequate, I think, with respect to study design. There's a bunch of questions that they don't really answer very well. There's a few things that we need to know. I mean, they don't tell us, for example, what are the words that they're going to be looking at, that this computer program is going to take out of the emails. What's their definition of a negative word, and what's a positive word, and are any of those words that they're looking at going to suggest other things like possible and repeated words, and possible psychological problems for the respondent? It is even possible to determine suicidality sometimes if you're looking at this sort of word usage. I think the IRB would want to know, what exactly are these words that you're looking at? And how many times are you looking at them? Is this just the email the day after the game? Or is it an email every day? Are they going to look at 10 emails? Are they going to look at every email until the next game? So they don't tell you that in study design, whether it's a one-time deal or whether they're going to do it on several different occasions. I mean, they can't even tell us whether they're going to do this after home games where students may be paying more attention, or after away games too. So there's a bunch of there's information in the research plan that's just missing. I think the wording of the emails is going to be incredibly important. I'll talk about that in a minute. They don't provide a statistical analysis plan how are they going to analyze this information. they don't really elucidate much about the inclusion criteria, except that they're all students here or some other unspecified university, which they should have said where that is. And they don't sort of make any indication that they actually realize that they're dealing with this student population to begin with, because they're looking at students from a particular relatively upscale university. Okay. This is not, this is a, you know, I assume they'll have to consider themselves someone to be on the community college, but anymore. So there's a number of things in the inclusion criteria that are not addressed. So equitable selection needs to address that. They need to give us a reason why they're just doing it here and at this other university where they may be. We'll talk about exclusion and the opt-out in more detail in a few minutes. They say they're going to analyze 200 students for each site, but they don't provide a power analysis, if they could even possibly get a power analysis done. They could, actually. So there's insufficient information there. The other thing that I would like to know is, does the athletic department usually send out an email after games to say, hey, we won or hey, we lost? Is that the usual practice or is that an unusual practice? And does that make the athletic department part of the research? So that's another question that the investigators need to answer.
That actually brings up an interesting issue. If the athletic department is there, it seems like they're collaborating with the research project, and I'm okay with that in principle. And theoretically, the use of anonymous emails and sent out, that could be okay. I think I have a bigger question about the university text message system. So all this information is being obtained, the use of email, it's going to be anonymous, it's from the athletic department. Maybe if it was just from the email, maybe I'd feel less uncertain about it. But when I think of a university text message system, I don't know if necessarily, I think we want to talk to more than just the athletic department. Because the university text message systems, typically, there's a crime on campus. There's some type of emergency. Don't report tomorrow. So I wanted to know, is there some type of larger support from the university to do this project that involves, an intervention with the text message system? I can imagine a scenario where that could be possible, where they'd want to do some type of large-scale intervention, maybe if it was something affecting the campus as a whole. But to use the text message as an intervention when this is typically used usually for emergency use. I think I'd want to see documentation support from more than just the athletic department.
Yeah.
Is this an issue the university would want to pursue? And again, not to trivialize the subject of the research, but is boosting mood after football games, is that something that aligns with the university's mission? Maybe if it was something along the line, maybe if it was something related to student health or health of the community at large, maybe the university could get on board with that type of intervention. But responses to football games, I don't think they would necessarily want to risk people opting out of their text message system for that.
Yes, and it's difficult for me to see how people could opt out of a specific text message. I'm sure all things are possible through IT, but perhaps not. So if you are all IRB members, which you now are, even though you all haven't taken CIT entry and stuff, does anybody even think this isn't even research? And should it even go to an IRB? Is it research?
Okay. It's not normal. It's not normal evaluation.
Wait. research is not normal.
This study this is not normal evaluation of the institution.
Right. So it's not a quality improvement. It's not. But I think what I'm trying to get at is that it is research because the authors of the protocol say, okay, this is going to be generalizable knowledge, and that automatically makes it research because they're clearly going to publish and they get some results, or at least present. So it's going to be made known to the population in general, even if only here at Illinois or any other university. So I think it's clearly research. Whether it comes to a full board review or whether it gets expedited or exempt is an IRB decision. And I don't think we have enough information in the protocol to make that decision. Maybe it doesn't have to go to the full board, but
for me, a lot of these issues that we're raising, we have to phrase them in a very directive way. So for example, when we talked about the waiver or alteration of consent, they have to provide those clarifications in the protocol, and assuming that all the assumptions we made, we kind of have to document what assumptions we made in the minutes, and if the response didn't align with what we were kind of assuming what would happen, then we might send it back to the full board. Kind of saying like, hey, based on my assumption, it seems like this is impractical, but you still need to make these updates. With the text message system, that could be a deal breaker for me. But again, I don't know the infrastructure. So hypothetically, if it's a text message system where only emergency or health related information is communicated, I think that might be a deal breaker, and I'd want to get somebody else from the university involved. But if the people who are receiving these text messages are part of like a booster club, or if it's part of like, hey, I'm opting into receipt because I want to know when the games are, I want to know when the pep rallies are happening, and this is separate from the emergency system, I would feel much differently about it. And at that point, it's really in line with what they're expecting on everyday life. They're saying, oh yeah, this is when the basketball game is, this is when. And then, if all they were doing was tinkering some content that's normally going out anyway, the manipulation, I feel like we have an easier time saying it's minimal risk versus are people going to find out there's a potential research study going on and opt out and then not find out that there's, been a crime on campus. But that could be the case, and they could potentially clarify that, but they didn't really address that. So we kind of talked about how an alteration of the consent process or an opt-out consent process could be feasible for this research, but we didn't really talk about what that would look like. You
know? Yeah, I have an idea. I don't do this kind of study, but if I was forced to do this kind of study, I might want to compose a series of emails that would initially introduce the students to the potential of the study, describe it in a few little uncertain terms, perhaps maybe generate some interest, follow it up with another email that says, okay, in this next week you're going to get another email about this that will ask you whether you want to opt out of receiving further information about the study, and if so, you want to contact it again. And then sort of finally get around to the IRB would have to review the content of each of these emails. But finally get around to the email that had the opt-out box on it. But also let people know who perhaps were interested or who did not send back the opt-out email, in further emails, that they can quit at any time they want to. Just because they didn't send the opt-out email back doesn't mean they can't send an email at some point and say, hey, I don't want to do this anymore, so just take them off your list, which probably would work better here than it works for the random dial telephone calls that we all get 5 times a day.
Yeah,
various people. So anyway, I think that's one way to approach it with the email. I think once you have your list of potential participants, you can add another IRB-approved email that would describe the study as you want to describe it, you know, leaving out some of the key parts so that you can actually get the data that you need. And if that email is worded properly and sort of is the consent form, well, then I think that's a possible way to approach this. You know, how you're going to figure out how to do the deception, it's a little bit out of my area of expertise, but I'm sure that, you know, clever social behavior of people figure out how to do that. So I don't know if you have other thoughts on the process.
I mean, overall, in terms of like what an informed, a basic informed consent process would look like, I think a lot of my thoughts on that can't really be finalized because we don't really know the mechanics of the system. I kind of spoke to this extensively already. I guess my general overall approach would be, just in general, is start at full informed consent and work your way backwards. Why can't you do it in full informed consent? I can see a scenario where they could come back and say, it's not practical to even, we could potentially email people and let them know that they're doing a research study involving the text message system, and you can opt out of it at any point in time. I could see the researcher pushing back and saying that a series of emails would maybe get lost, or there would be some sort of email fatigue. I don't know. I think I would want to have a conversation with the researcher in terms of the infrastructure for the text message system, what type of emails they're getting, what that email would look like ahead of time, and the overall support for this project. So that one's a little bit tricky. I could see anywhere from a almost informed consent process where they didn't just describe the purpose and they said you can opt out of it. But if they had sufficient rationale, which isn't included here, they could potentially not include anything. But we'd want to see a really thorough debriefing form at that point. Either way, we don't have the rationale. I mean, one of the things when we ask for, we go through an alteration or a waiver of consent, that's one of the things that the investigator needs to speak in detail to, why it isn't feasible, why it isn't practicable. The IRB is always going to take the position that informed consent is the way to go. It's the researcher's obligation to say, why would informed consent, you know, make this project infeasible? Or if a series of emails would make it so, hey, you know, we could send these emails, but based on our data, nobody reads emails. Still, it's not going to be an effective tool. They could come back with something, but I would say the onus would be on that. But that information isn't here.
It's not here. There's a few other things that were left out of the protocol by the investigators. They ask about the protocol form, asks about protection of the data that they collect, so that if they have data on their computers, and it's also possible that somebody with a lot of computer expertise could get back into this slow email system and actually find out who these people are, and then maybe discriminate against them because they weren't depressed or somebody who lost or something like that. We need to know, you know, are these researchers taking data off campus? Are their computers encrypted? You know, are they totally aware of all of the roles and so forth? So they don't really address that. They just say no identifiable. You know, there's no identifiable information. But you know, we all know that you know, in the current state of computer hacking and so forth, pretty much everything is identifiable these days. So.
That's where I want to see, that's why I want to have the conversation with the IT security expert, to just verify that the researcher's assumptions are true. I would say for this particular protocol, assuming If the institution wants Villanova, University of Villanova is not a covered entity, the system, we're not collecting health information. So HIPAA necessarily wouldn't apply. HIPAA security would only apply if it was directly identifiable protected health information. But I would want to verify those things were true. If the IT security folks who collaborated with the researchers could give us an independent review and say, hey, we can confirm that the data is truly anonymous. So if a hacker were to break into our system where we store our research data, all they would get would be emails that have this benign text, and they wouldn't have email addresses. If I were to get that confirmation from IT, I would think that I'd be comfortable with it.
So, it's, I think, they also refer to a sub-study that, or another study that a graduate student might use this data for, but they don't address whether they don't address that protocol, or they don't address whether it's a sub-study or a separate study. They need separate IRB approval, and it may need a whole separate application for another review. They say in one area that they are obtaining a certificate of confidentiality, although I'm not required for this particular study because certificates of confidentiality protect against disclosure to financial institutions, healthcare agencies, and so forth, personal data that could be damaging to an individual participant. So I don't really see that they need that for this particular study. I mean, they might need it if they were talking about a study involving, you know, HIV or hepatitis or sexual behavior, stuff like that. But I think it's also in this particular study. They don't address, I mean, the unlikely possibility that one of the reasons that I wanted to ask them the words that they were searching for in these emails was that if the analysis identified patterns that could be associated with severe depression or suicidality, if that were to happen, how would they deal with that? Who did they refer to? Do they have any mechanism in place that allows them to deal with that issue?
What about the enrollment of children?
Yeah, IRB members, what do you think about that? Are they children? These 17-year-olds?
If they're under 18, they're children.
According to the law, yeah.
So, I mean, assuming we got responses to all the issues we raised, where we're missing pieces in the protocol, and they provided sufficient justification for waiving informed consent, and they had adequate responses to all those things, we had no issues with the text message system, with the confidential, all these issues that they've been addressed, we might have to ask ourselves, okay, are we doing a subpart D for this protocol? So I would say yes, we would do a subpart D, because, you know, there could be 17-year-olds enrolling in the study. So now the follow-up, we already agreed from our previous determination that it's minimal risk. But the follow-up question is parental permission required? That's a little bit tricky, because we kind of already said that we could potentially alter the informed consent process. So we kind of want to prove an altered informed consent process for this overall study. So I guess the question, we'd have to apply that same four criteria, but this time to the waiver of parental permission. So we already agreed it's not a risk. Let's say they've provided sufficient justification as to why they couldn't send out a full informed consent via email. They already provided a debriefing plan in response to our issues earlier. And then the ultimate question was, okay, would the waiver adversely affect their rights and welfare? And I would say no. I would say, you know, if they're in college, I don't think there's not a lot of decisions that would happen for a freshman 17-year-old on campus I don't know. I mean, at that point, they're sent to college to, you know, kind of become an adult, make their own decisions. Maybe they started kindergarten a little bit earlier than their classmates. I don't think not telling their parents would have an adverse effect on their rights or welfare. That's just...
No, I don't think so either. I was totally mature my freshman year in college.
So, I mean, based on our discussion, I mean, we kind of jumped ahead to pretend like we got the responses. But based on our overall discussion, I think we, my recommendation would be to table the protocol. Because we have too many open-ended questions. The other thing that I would have considered doing if I got this protocol in a real-life situation is I would have emailed the IRB administrator, the IRB pre-reviewer, and I would have sent these questions in advance of the meeting, and I would have said, hey, is there any way we can get responses to these questions before we meet? And if not, could we possibly schedule it for an agenda when we can get some of these bigger questions raised? So, I mean, the reality is we spent 45 minutes talking about one protocol. There could be a lot of protocols on the agenda. Maybe we don't have time or resources to do that. So if we got these questions into the meeting earlier, we could have kind of, a lot of this what if, that could have been addressed by the researcher before the meeting. But.
So basically what you're, am I understanding you correctly, that you would not call this a full review, even though they're 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds, possibly, in this study. Am I, did I hear you correctly?
No. I would say we would conduct a subpart D review for this protocol because of the potential to enroll 17-year-olds. And I would recommend the approval of the altered consent process for those 17-year-olds and recommended waiving parental permission. But what's tricky about it is I wouldn't have made that recommendation unless they provided sufficient rationale for why informed consent wasn't possible. I can envision a rationale as to why it's not possible, but it's not.
So as the IRB, if I were the IRB chair, I think because of what they're saying, because it does involve deception, is a much more complicated study than the investigators indicate. I would opt for a full board review of this particular study. You know, if we found at the full board that it's a minimal risk study, then you know, if they carry on next year, it doesn't have to go to the full board for continuing review. It can be done expedited. But I think for initial review, I would opt for a full board personally. But that's maybe more conservative than I usually am.
I'm in pretty much agreement in terms of the use of deception. I think, I mean, there may be change with the revised common rule, there may be changes about when deception is permitted and not permitted. I don't want to go down that wormhole just yet. But in terms of the use of deception, the reason why I prefer to send these to the full board is because the practicability of the research is something I don't necessarily feel comfortable doing at the acceptor expedited level. Because it's not always, so in this we were kind of talking a lot about the logistics of getting informed consent. But sometimes the use of deception, it might be a bigger question of, you know, is that the only way to do this research project, to answer this research question? And that's, so, and where that falls on the scale. And sometimes as an IRB, we can be more flexible if there's an informed consent process, which includes language like, hey, we can't always tell you about every single piece of the purpose. And generally, if they're in some type of behavioral lab or research situation, I think there's an understanding that, like, hey, we can't tell you why we're asking you this question. It's going to bias your results. And I think those types of projects are much more benign. But in the situation where we're just not going to tell people they're involved in a research study, generally, the responsibility of the researcher is to say, this is the only way we can answer this research question. And my favorite, like I said, I already alluded to this earlier, but my favorite deception projects are the ones where, you know, and I've seen them a lot in healthcare research, where it's like, hey, we want to see if these people in college admissions or if these people who work at these healthcare practices, if they're accepting these patients. When they come to us and say, we don't know how else to get this, if we tell them we're researchers, they're not going to answer honestly. And there's no way to collect this data as an observational study. I really can't focus. But on other hands, on the other hand, you know, I don't like it.
And there's probably no way to collect the data as a retrospective analysis either. Not that I can think of anyway. Yeah, how many people here as IRB members? I mean, all of you are IRB members. Right? Mm-hmm. How many think you want to go to a full board versus an expedited committee? Full board? Expedited? Let's see. Good. Anybody make additional observations on this study?
So I'm the PI who submitted that protocol, and I would be, and you've typed up your responses to me. I can hear it now, like, what to what? All I want to do is measure the moon on campus, and you're killing me here with all of this stuff. Like I can see it. We've lived it. Like, and I'm like, do you recall what you're saying? I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying, how do you make PIs understand that, you know, I understand you just want to send text messages out and like, you know, find out what the mood is on campus relative to, like, you know, winning or losing, but it's much deeper than that, you know? I mean, people don't know what they don't know, and like, you know, I never had, you guys are talking, I'm like, I never thought about that, but like, you know, some people are just like, yeah, we'll put the study together, here we go, you know, give it to the IRB, and they're like, if you have to list the questions, and you have to hide in your office because you're afraid. Like,
or
just
so,
then they add something, and that is, I've done this kind of a study before, and I know that this is not a high-risk study. That's part of the rest of the
work. I think based on our discussion, if we were sending the letter, we didn't say anything in the letter about it being a high-risk study. We talked about data integrity. We talked about data confidentiality. We talked about consent. And in some situations, I would really focus the discussion on that. I'd say, hey, I think it's a good. I feel like, and this is more strategy than policy. But in a lot of situations, I might say, like, I might talk about, like, hey, these are the parts that the board had a question about. The board didn't say anything about why you're doing this study. It's a really neat idea. We want to help you get this project up and running, but it's our responsibility to do this in an ethical way. So sometimes, unfortunately, one of the drawbacks of being an IRB member is sometimes you kind of have to sell. You're kind of like a salesperson for human subjects, like human research ethics. So sometimes you have to do it with a customer service voice, and you have to do things where deep down I'm saying, oh my gosh, I'm an IRB member. It's on the, we said in the meeting, oh, it's on the researcher to provide justification as to why. It's not my problem. But then when you talk to the researcher, it's, I understand what you're trying to do, but it's an IRB. And then you have to explain, you have to make a sales pitch about autonomy and why people may or may not want to participate in this intervention and what you need. So that's kind of my strategy for dealing with that.
If the PI wants to communicate with an IRB member who's a primary reviewer, is that acceptable, not acceptable? Like,
the other way around, I think. The IRB member can communicate with the PI.
We can directly.
You certainly can, and you should. Some people want to remain anonymous as IRB members, but in general, you would not tell a PI who the reviewer is. So if the reviewer wants to get a clarification from the PI or his staff, then that's fine. But, you know, regarding the other issue about, you know, the irate PI calling up. Or, I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how many times I've had this conversation in the last 25 years with PIs. But if I had a dollar for every time, I would have been paying 58 minutes hours on my 2015 taxes. That was a bad joke.
This part of the IRB meeting.
This part of the IRB meeting is definitely bad jokes. And unfortunately, I was often covered. So I think when you get those kind of phone calls, you have to kind of say, look, the IRB is not your enemy. The IRB is here to protect the research subjects. We want to make sure studies are done ethically. We want to make sure that if we're going to get 3,000 students or 200 students or whatever to participate in a study, we need enough information to determine if this study is actually going to provide or has the potential of providing any meaningful information. So the only way we can do that is for us to have all the information that we need to be able to discuss and analyze and evaluate in the IRB to make that sort of decision. And you know, usually, I mean, with a few exceptions, the investigators turn out to be pretty reasonable if you, if you talk to them in that way and explain, you know, why you have to do certain things. And sometimes you have to, you know, read the federal regulations to them. Sometimes you just send them to them by email. You
usually try to phrase the issues around either the regulatory criteria or the issue, and try to make it like a lot of people get very defensive about their projects, but instead it's just instead of saying like, we don't understand why you're doing this, the question may be more along the lines of like, hey, so as an IRB, we have to determine that informed consent's met, or that the criteria for waiving informed consent's met. And one that we struggled with was the practicability. So can you help us? Where are we, what are we missing? And I kind of like, I'm going to draw attention to that. Then if they're yelling at you after that, then like, you know, I don't know what else to say. Some people, some investigators, and it could be investigators who just inherently have a problem with IRBs reviewing their research. We're not going to win that war. But if we can kind of like really focus on like the issues that are like focus on the actual ethical issues. This is a tough example. This is a tough case because people don't know. So because nobody knows that it's a research study, I think like, hey, like, if all these people don't know they're in a research study, are you gonna actually produce like actionable research results? But in the other cases, you know, if participants are getting full informed consent, then maybe some of those, like we asked for the statistical analysis plan. And for this, it's very important. But if the subjects signed in a full informed consent form, knows the risks, knows what the types of questions they're going to be asked, knows the purpose of the research. Again, I would say you should really have a statistical analysis plan, but at that point, the subject's autonomy kind of trumps my review as a IRB member. Whereas in this case, there is no subject autonomy, so I'm treating it very differently. Yeah.
So I actually had a question to that very point. And I'm not an advocate for funding research, but I always understood that the IRB was not commenting on the scientific value of the study, just on the technical. So you're saying these are, you can't separate the scientific value from technical people.
The IRB is not charged with scientific review, but ethically, I think you don't want to approve a study that doesn't have a chance of producing meaningful data, if possible. So you don't want, because you know, if it's an above minimal risk study and it's so poorly designed that you can't possibly get anything out of it that would be helpful to anybody, then why would you want to put anybody at risk? So in this case, why would you want to waste the time of 200 students who, you know, could be busy doing something else and they're going to spend 5 hours, you know, writing emails or whatever, or trying to respond?
It's a tricky question because both of us sit on environmental hierarchies as well. And when you talk about risk minimization, science is on the table. Because if it's not conducted in a way that, you know, if the gold standard at the hospital is like, oh yeah, they wouldn't normally receive that treatment, there's safety implications, and at that point, you want to make sure it's being conducted in a safe way. But for when you already determine that the study's minimal risk, that's when that question becomes really difficult. And the strategy, and full disclosure, I sit on IRBs, but I also work in research administration. And my strategy for dealing with that has been really relying heavily on the departmental review. So for student research projects, I would say, you know, okay, there's a full informed consent process, you have a data confidentiality plan, but from a scientific perspective, I don't know. I've reviewed too many research projects. I don't know if you're going to contribute anything to the science. But at that point, when I go meet with department heads, I say, hey, you guys, you're the faculty advisor here. You're the one who's mentoring the student as part of their PhD program or part of their master's program. You know, I think it's your responsibility to make sure that this research is being done in a scientifically appropriate way. Maybe it's not going to impact the IRB review, but if that relationship's happening before it comes to the IRB, a lot of these issues go away sometimes.
I think the scientific evaluation question is really important. I mean, the federal regulations specify that you have to have scientific expertise on the IRB. There's a reason for that. There are literally hundreds of IRBs across the country that get studies that have had no prior scientific review. So in that case, it's really up to the IRB to say, okay, this is kind of scientifically sound as far as we can tell, or send it out to somebody who knows, you know, and get an outside opinion. But many, many places don't have any peer review, or they have, you know, department chairs that never even look at a research study that's going to be submitted. They just sign off on it. Yes, this can be done by my department, that's fine. So I think the scientific review is kind of an important aspect, even though it's not the mission of the IRB, the ethics is.
So this takes me back to a scenario of, like, 4 or 5 years ago, undergraduate research course, 1 semester long. You want them to have some hands-on experience that's real. So we did craft these little proposals, you know, ask some classmates how they picked their specialty in nursing as they're seeking jobs. I mean, it was not contributing to the science at all, but it was an intuitive as important, you know, a practice piece. So can you justify that?
I don't know if that's is that a research?
Is it a research or quality improvement?
No, it's not QA. It was a little research design.
Research design.
Group students did in the context of an undergraduate 1 semester course. So they had to create their proposal, go to IRB, do the study, write the results.
Yeah, so classroom activities are generally exempted from IRB.
Really?
Standard classroom things, but I think under the circumstances that you're describing, that you probably be consent protocol. I mean, you would submit a form to the IRB requesting an exemption.
Well,
I guess as you would have gotten it.
It was. but I mean, it doesn't fulfill any criterion of contributing meaningful science.
Right.
It's just an exercise.
So it's an exercise
of
teaching somebody, you know, how to do research, hopefully, and do it right. So, yeah, I would see that as a classroom exercise that would be accepted. Now, if you're going to publish it and you know, stuff like that, that's interesting.
Anybody else have any questions?
Yeah.
Maybe not pertaining to this particular case, but you know, IRB review questions.
Except for citizens, you can't have any hard questions.
So I have a question, I guess specifically about this, but it's maybe more generalizable. There's language in here about there's no risk to the subjects because the emails are going to be de-identified. But is the text of this email, put your hat on, that you pretend you're this PI, if the text of this email is sitting on someone's hard drive, the context of that text, even if the two from lines are gone and IP addresses are gone, within the context of that, isn't there identifiable information? So does that completely roll this whole conversation back? Or is there some IT person that's scrambling all of the letters and words?
Well,
like, I don't know how.
We also asked for the content of the email. That was one of the first questions we had. So that would kind of drive the bus on what we felt about, like, if there was risk with that. It's like,
so then if they came back and said, so the full text of these emails, the two from lines and dates and all that are gone, is going to lie on someone's laptop somewhere.
Sure.
How would the conversation
change? Dear
grandma,
how's everything going in your little section of Mount Valley, New Jersey?
Or, hey, John Doe, what a great hazing opportunity we had yesterday at the frat. that's a little problem, right?
Or we would certainly treat that differently. Again, the conversation with the IT expert would be like, hey, they've got some sensitive content in this email. This anonymization process that you have is important to the review of this protocol. On the flip side, if it was, hey, students, don't you like football as much as we do? I'm going to be the first to say that's not putting at risk, even if somebody gets their hand. Yeah?
Well, I have a question about the opt-out people. Is there an obligation to protect their identity?
As part of this overall protocol, I think that all of the email, I think the overall goal was that everybody was anonymized. So if that's the case, if they confirm that to be true with the response, then I would say yes. So that's an issue that comes up a lot, and I don't want to get too like health system driven because that's kind of where my head's at most days. But a common issue that we have in healthcare research is, you know, you may be allowed to have access to identifiable data to see who's available to be in your research study. And a lot of people, when they say like, oh, they're not enrolled, but we have access to their data, I feel like a lot of researchers don't think about protecting that data because they're not participants. And it's tricky because if they're not participants, it may not be under the IRB's purview, so it may not make it into the application. But just from an ethical standpoint, I would say absolutely there's an obligation to protect it because this could be going out to all these people, and we kind of have to assume at that point if everybody's getting the message that they're research participants. And if people are opting out, what's the mechanism in place to remove any of their data from the system? So if there's like a data set that has every student's email in it, and the person opts out and says, stop, I don't want to get these messages anymore, what's the plan for destroying that data afterwards? And that's a piece, I think that's a great question, because I think that's a piece that people miss very often.
Yeah, because in Villanova, 6,000 students get the email, 5,890 opt out. And if their identities are not protected, the 10 who opted in are known as the group of 10 anyway.
Right. When you say, what's the plan for destroying that data, what are you looking for in an answer for that question?
So
if it's all like being housed electronically, is it so like, I guess beyond like the standard, like I'm going to delete that email, like how are you actually removing it from your data set? How are you like physically removing that person's name from your contact list? And I'll be perfectly honest, the reason why I kept harping on it, in some of these situations, I may ask for an IT consult on this and say, hey, I want to make sure that when they say remove, it really means remove. And sometimes the IT guy who comes in, who could provide a consult, could say, no, they're saying that they're removing it, but there's a whole section over here. It's still in there. There's backups of this file all over the place. Like, and there could be, and that could be a function where an IT expert could say, no, this is what you actually have to do to remove this from either from the server where it's being stored or from your own personal device.
Yeah, including the two or three backup servers that protect all of those data and so forth.
And is the intensity of that line of questioning going to vary with the degree of risk that the study entails?
I think it was going to, if you say you're going to destroy the stuff, you have to just completely destroy it. Whether it's minimal risk or minimal risk.
Yeah, when you're thinking about data confidentiality plans, I wouldn't think about it in like greater minimal risk or minimal risk terms, because I think in a lot of situations when you're doing a research study with just social behavior, you know, everybody's accepted that it's minimal risk. I would actually treat it in terms of sensitivity. So it's all, you kind of accept the notion that the data collection is all minimal risk, but what are the implications for that data set? So if you have a bunch, if you have a data set, so I'm not advocating for loose confidentiality plans for non-sensitive data, but on the flip side, if the data set is, you know, Dave Hegarty at UPenn.edu, and next to it says, loves football. And again, I mean, I'm joking, but that's kind of like the subject of this study. Versus, you know, Dave Hegarty at UPenn.edu, you know, hazes students on the weekends, or is a substance user, or something like that, then at that point, I'm treating their data protection much, much differently.
I think this question of data security also has to be considered in light of the consent process here, because if there were full informed consent, you could identify the risks of the possibility of data recovery or linking back to you. Without a consent that does that, you have to think carefully about how you're protecting that data. You haven't given the subjects any information about the risk, that aspect of the risk.
Yeah, I agree. That's kind of, again, not to get to healthcare, I'm going to keep going back to healthcare stuff. That's my current line of work, sorry. But when we review data with like protected health information, for instance, a lot of these questions about like improper use and disclosure, the whole reason why these questions are put in place is because, you know, if people don't have the opportunity to consent or provide authorization for the use of their data, at that point it may become the IRB's responsibility to make sure that it's okay. So if a student project, for example, says, hey, I want to collect identifiable information from you, I'm going to put your picture on my poster at my presentation, the person agrees to it from an IRB perspective, it's fine. They agreed to have identifiable information shared. If the person agrees to say, oh yeah, put my information up there, tell them that I hate people, tell them that I do drugs. It sounds like I'm being facetious, but I'm not. There's people who want their story shared sometimes. So a lot of people kind of get lost in this, it has to be de-identified, it has to be anonymous, it has to be, because it falls into that exemption category. It's really, we're treating it differently in this case because the choice is getting taken away.
But an individual can disclose anything about themselves. Getting back to your question about the content of the emails, I mean, there are programs that a lot of places use that identify PHI, protect health information, and they work pretty good. You know, I can think of three or four examples of where people have sent inadvertently protected health information to an email to another institution. The program picks it up and says, hey, this is PHI issue, you really want to send it in. You know, usually it's a surprise, but there are such programs, and I would think that you could either devise or have programs that actually pick that kind of stuff out of these emails in this particular state also. Yes, it turns into a really complicated study, doesn't it?
Could you comment also on the equitable selection of subjects in this study as it's written here?
Sure. Maybe Dave. it's clearly a skewed population. We don't know what the other university is. That may balance the charts some way, a little bit. Of the population that they pick, they're not excluding Villanova students, except those that are using email, which are probably zero. But they have to recognize and say in their protocol that they know that they're not getting the cross section of humanity. You know, they're getting a population, healthy, above average students at a particular university. And I think as long as they do that, and as long as they're able, they would actually want to do that in the publication as well. Here's our data, but here's the caveat. Just doesn't represent the cross-section of all students in the USA.
Right, because the second university could be like Brigham Young College or something like that.
Yeah, or it could be some really lovely place like Penn.
Friends are right.
Hey, we know Jefferson and good friends, but we know where the big money is. But no, I think I think it's a legitimate question. I think they should deal with it in a above board, honest way. And any journal editor would often say, sorry, you got to include this in your manuscript. Certainly, you can get somebody from IT to take it off of some little space on the end of your hard drive, someplace, some partition that no one else knows about.
And if there's an informed consent process that conveys that, that's okay. I mean, a lot of consent forms, when I'm helping investigators write consent forms, and they're saying, oh, yeah, no, we'll never share your data with anybody, my first response is, are you sure about that? Do you want to revisit that one? The goal of research is to produce knowledge, to share data. I mean, for example, federally funded studies, NIH has a data sharing requirement. You have to share data. So the idea that nobody's sharing data is silly. But on the flip side, in the context of this study, or in some studies, when you're talking about people who didn't even know there was a research study that they were involved in, their data's been collected inadvertently, maybe they opt out, I think we're gonna treat those a little bit differently than we would somebody who signs an informed consent form that has, hey, this is what we're gonna do with the data, we're gonna share it with all these people. You can withdraw from any time, but withdrawing doesn't necessarily mean that your data is removed.
One of the reasons that I think a written informed consent is really important the rest studies, particularly biomedical, is that you can put this stuff in the sample. So the example that I used this morning was the echocardiograph results, where the clinical echocardiograph machines cannot be scrubbed of identifiers. So the name of the person and the medical record number is always on those images. So you have to just tell somebody in the consent form, you know, there's no way to take your identifying information off of your echocardiogram, but we're sending it to this data analysis center, and they will have this information about it. They will do the best that they can to protect the information, but it can't be guaranteed. So if you upfront just tell it that that's a possibility. But if you said that in like, that the reason I said written form, with the written consent, this patient has a copy, you have a copy as a researcher. And that's the sort of thing that would sort of just get lost in the world.